Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Book Network Hindu Studies Channel podcast. I'm your host today, Craig Ginn from the University of Calgary, and I will be chatting with Dr. Raj Balkaran, talking about his book, The Goddess and the King in Indian Myth, Ring Composition, Royal Power, and the Dharmic Double Helix. Welcome to the interview today, Raj.
It's actually a pleasure to be on the other side of the chair today, of the desk, I should say.
Yeah, because you normally would do these interviews, wouldn't you?
I normally would, and it's sort of kind of fun to just sit back and let someone else do the work.
Well, we should also tell our audience that you and I have done a few podcast recordings for Introduction to Religious Studies at Ryerson and U of C, University of Calgary, and so we're accustomed to chatting with many miles between us and using technology.
Absolutely. Craig and I have recorded before, and the very first time occurred, I believe, in, let's see, maybe 2012-ish. I was walking in the hallway in the department and he pulls me in and we give an impromptu interview on the Indian worldview. Do you remember that?
I do happen to remember that. You were a PhD student at the time, and I was looking for a conversation partner, and timely, let's put it that way. And you were very cooperative and did an excellent job, as I recall.
He strapped me down and I felt I had no choice. So, you know, no, it was fun. It was good fun. We definitely have had, the thing is, I think the first couple of years of our interaction, we were, our conversations could have been podcasts. We just didn't have anything to record them with at the time.
That's true. Well, let's dive into this book if you're ready to start chatting about it. And, first of all, the title is intriguing. I mean, it's got this word Dharmic Double Helix. Is that really the core idea of the book or part of the core idea?
It's definitely one of the core ideas. It's an idea that's important to the book and also to Hindu studies at large. And it's essentially this pervasive tension we see in Hinduism between ascetic ideology and householder ideology. And what I say is householder ideology is epitomized by the king, so we'll call it royal ideology. Got tons and tons of stories of kings in exile talking to forest ascetics, and I present this idea that that is a literary encapsulation of this tension that never goes away in Hinduism, because it never goes away in life. It's a tension between the inner life and the outer life, really.
Yeah, and you have coined that phrase, haven't you?
Yeah, it came to me one day while I was writing. This must have been 2014, 2015.
Yeah. And so there's some contrast here that you're trying to pull together. One is, as you say, the ascetic or the renunciate, world denouncing, we might say, and then the world affirming role of the householder. And you see those in a healthy tension, do you?
Well, they're definitely in tension. And I think that trying to resolve the tension, is as problematic as it is, short-sighted. The tension cannot be resolved. So ascetic ideology and royal ideology, the dharma of the householder in the world, and the dharma of the renouncer who renounces the world, they're going to be necessarily structural opposites. What happens in Hinduism is that they get folded back in. They can't ever converge, right? They're two strands. but they're two strands that get intertwined so that if you take a step back, you see these two strands are actually part of the same double helical structure as opposed to opposing strands.
Right. And then as you work this concept into your book or use this concept as a way to inform the hermeneutic of in your book, you on page 52 refer to the ascetic ideology and the royal ideology. And that's a critical lens here.
I would say those are the two strands, right? The quintessence of the two strands are the ascetic and the king. And I take my cue really because this book, which we probably will talk about in a moment, is about the mythology of the great goddess in India. All of the insights came tumbling out with this inaugural question: Why are these glories of the goddess told to a king by an ascetic in the forest? Mm-hmm. And so these conversation partners are the conversation partners of these two overarching strands of Indian religiosity.
Right. And so when you think of the bigger picture, the central question then that you're asking in this book, what would it be, the main thrust?
Well, I started off with this question of why are the glories of the goddess voiced by a forest-dwelling ascetic to a deposed king? That trope is elsewhere. It's throughout the epics, throughout the Mahabharata, for example. But also that stance decides to look at the frame narrative as crucial to the text. And that's something that counters 150 years of scholarship on the text. There's been very little scholarship, but scholarship on the Hindu mythological text, the Puranas in general, the tendency is to look at the text shorn away from the frame narrative whereby it's considered the text was interpolated. So what I do is I say, interpolation or not, there's conscious narrative design at play, and that Devi Mahatmya is stitched into the Markandeya Purana with this frame narrative for a very important specific reason. And in ignoring the frame narrative, you ignore the very hermeneutic key whereby the sense makes the most text, whereby the text makes the most sense.
so the hermeneutic key for you is to read this as, again, from the Dharmic double helix. Is that a hermeneutic device for yourself?
So the key for me in these stories is to actually pay very, very careful attention to the frame narrative. And I believe that's categorically true of Sanskrit narrative. So when applied in this case, when we're looking at the frame narrative, we see a conversation between the king and the king and the ascetic. So that Dharmic double helix is one very important hermeneutic pillar upon which the study rests. The other, because one can make the argument, okay, well, clearly the text is privileging both. These characters are both important. But the subsequent structure of the myths of the Devi themselves, they lend us to suggest that royal ideology is favored because of this thing called ring composition.
Right, and that's part of your title as well, isn't it? Ring composition.
Yes, it's another major theme of the book.
So what is a ring composition? To get to basics here.
A ring composition is really, if you look at the vast majority of stories that we love, whether from the ancient world, whether from Beowulf, whether from modern sci-fi fantasy, you'll find, I always think of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, there and back again. So it's A, B, and then back to A. Mm. Right? So it could be multiple parts. Like in the case of the Devi Mahatmya, it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, where 3 is the middle, 1 and 5 mirror, 2 and 4 mirror. So the idea is that the structure takes the form of a visual ring where you end up where you started, but obviously having gone through a journey.
Right. Now, you mentioned the word interpolation. Are you seeing more than one author behind this work and contributing to the ring theory or the ring composition structure?
I think the question, so I'll answer it on two levels. If we were to ask that question, yes. For me, it's clear that there would be multiple hands at work in terms of producing what we now have in hand as the Devi Mahatmya and the glories of the goddess. My research tends to ask in a synchronic fashion, what sense can we make of the finished product? Because all of those hands will have been, or certainly by the last redaction, by the last phase of editing the text, if you will, there was colossal conscious design of how the text should be laid out. And in looking to which parts were before that final stage, we actually eclipse the integrity of the way in which the text has landed, because it hasn't landed in this manner haphazardly, right? The ring composition is fundamental for the fabric of the text as it is currently. Who knows if that would have been the case in previous iterations or portions of the text? Mm-hmm.
And do you want to give us like the Coles Notes version of the Devi Mahatmya in 5 minutes or less? Is that possible? Sure. It's maybe an insulting question on the one hand.
Oh, not at all.
No,
not at all. No, there are many, many orders of resolution. If the 30,000 foot view is that there's a noble king who loses his throne and he is beside himself. He ventures into a forest. He comes across a merchant equally deposed. His merchant companion was thrown out by his own family due to their greed, and so we have these two existentially wandering, deposed, disenfranchised beings. By the way, they meet at an ashram, at a forest hermitage of a great sage, and they take respite there. They find respite there. They eventually ask the sage about the nature of why they're suffering. The sage explains the mechanics of suffering to them. And he goes on to say, well, this delusion you experience is nothing else but the great goddess, Mahamaya. The matrix is alive. The matrix is a goddess. Oh, by the way, she doesn't just delude you. She grants you whatever you want. And she finds you a way out of the maze, if that is your desire. She's actually the lady of all lords, if you will. She's the sovereign of all sovereigns. She's the queen of all kings. And all of a sudden, now the king is on fire. Noble sage, tell me, what are the acts of this goddess? Tell me about this majestic figure. And he goes, sure, no problem. And then he recounts three myths. Detailing the acts of the Divine Mother. And at the end of his rendition, the king and the merchant go off and they worship her. They make a murti along the banks of a river and they offer incense and fruit and water and they offer hymns. And she manifests before them and says, I'm pleased. By the way, this takes them three long years, during which they ate very little, if not at all. She manifests and says, I'm so pleased by your worship. I'll give you a boon, whatever you desire, I'll grant. The merchant says, look, I want that knowledge that'll sever me from this world, sever me from I-ness and my-ness, from possession and identity. I want the knowledge that grants truth. And the mother granted the merchant moksha. The king did not desire moksha. The king wanted his kingdom back. And the mother said to him, okay, let it be so. She empowered him, gave him the strength, and said to him, in 3 days' time, go forth and conquer your foe. The kingdom will be yours forevermore. And once you've left this world in your next life, you will be raised to the Manu of the next age. And so the frame narrative bespeaks this, it's ideologically rich in terms of encapsulating the ideology of the ascetic, the ideology of the king, this Brahmanic ideology that's this Dharma of double helix. It explains how the next Manu comes into being. This is his karmic antecedent, this whole tale. She doesn't chastise him for his desire for royal power. Mm-hmm. She rewards him for it. Why? because she does on the cosmic sphere what kings are meant to do on Earth. Leaders are meant to protect, the imperiled to protect the disenfranchised. And so this dharma of kingship is so fundamental to the fabric of existence, which the Devi is, that even this very, very, enticing, moral imperative of ahimsa, even this very pervasive, Upanishadic classical Hindu ideology of detachment that the merchant is so drawn to, even that is eclipsed by the necessity of maintaining the world, protecting Dharma, protecting the virtuous, punishing the wicked. And so, there in the nutshell is the frame narrative, which is the cornerstone of the thesis. If you'd like, we can actually go into the episodes themselves.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, one thing I thought I would segue from is, as you talk about the king and ideological emphases, the royal ideology of the virtue of violence. Can you comment on that and the dharmic virtue of violence?
Well, the first thing before commenting is to remind our audience or contextualize that question against the backdrop of this notion that violence cannot possibly be a virtue because nonviolence, ahimsa is the supreme virtue, right? It's the paramount in dharma, ahimsa, to never do harm, to do no harm. And there's something obviously very captivating and intuitively sound about that imperative. Now, the problem arises with the dharmas of specific folks.
Because mm-hmm. the king wouldn't be under the same obligation to fulfill ahimsa as the ascetic would.
Well, ahimsa comes out of this renouncer movement, this ascetic ideology that gets folded back into Hinduism. And the proxy for the ascetic would be the brahmana, the sagacious scholar priest who can now be detached. There are no more animal sacrifices and can do no harm in that sense. Having said that, what happens at the beginning of the Ramayana, the sages come to Rama and say, the demons are desecrating our sacrifices. Please protect us. Please preserve the sacrifice. Protection requires violence because you're protecting against those who would destroy. So the destruction of those who would destroy, the destruction of the destructive, must be practically construed as a virtue. So the virtue of violence is the virtue of the penchant of the Kshatriya class, of the warrior class, of royal ideology, right? The sanguinary duty of kings, that we must shed blood in the name of protecting all that is sacred, so to speak. Ironically, ahimsa itself must be safeguarded. Nonviolence must be safeguarded by bloodshed.
Right. And so you mentioned the Kshatriya, and that's a higher ranking caste, and its dharma as a warrior is to protect those who can't protect themselves.
No, the two highest ranking castes are, and whether we want to see castes as a reality on the ground or the way I look at it in the book as ideologically important. This is how the world was conceived as it should be, whether it is this way. But the two highest castes are the Brahmanas and the Kshatriyas. And they are the beginnings of these two strands of the Dharma Tripitaka, right? Mm. Like to really simplify, this is sacred power versus secular power, right? Or outer power versus inner power.
And how is Durga's power framed within that? Because I mean, she's in some ways the epitome of violence and power. How is she framed within any virtue of violence?
Well, what's fascinating about the Devi Mahatmya is that it's the first articulation within Hinduism. It's the first time we see a Sanskrit text that advances the supreme as feminine. It's in its current form. It's probably from 5th-6th century CE. The text actually, it's a mythologization of power as a principle itself. The supreme goddess is a personification of power itself. And so that power classically has these two outlets, these two applications, social power, and spiritual power. What's interesting is that the goddess of the text, if you look to the middle episode, which I argue is central because in ring composition, the midpoint is the central point. There's one arm of the journey towards the goal, and then there's a journey back, and that goal is the midpoint. So the middle episode, which I argue is the crux of the text from a ring composition point of view, is one where the gods of heaven are disempowered. The throne was usurped by the buffalo demon Mahisha, and the goddess herself is manifest. She becomes manifest through their collective wrath, their fire, their tejas. And from that collective energy, the goddess congeals and destroys the demonic foe, and the gods, their power is restored. Now, this power is very much a social, political power, in that Indra regains his throne of heaven, and is heavily implicated in spiritual power or subtle dimensions, in that now the sacrifice, the shares of the sacrifice from the earth plane can be allotted dharmically. Now, okay. they can. So she is portrayed as a personification of power. That is both the power that the sages hone to achieve enlightenment, and also the power that kings hone for their purposes.
Okay, and then what about the sacrificial element of bloodshed? You make some comment on that in the book, and also the didactic purpose of the stories. Can you blend those two elements can you address those two elements, the didactic nature of the work and also bloodshed as a sovereign sacrifice?
In terms of the didactic nature of the work, stories are arguably didactic by their very nature. Certainly in the Hindu tradition, stories like the epics and the Puranas are told to teach. Mm-hmm. They hold the most powerful way to inculcate generations in a specific ideology or philosophical bent is to tell stories that encode that. And so unconsciously, one is conditioned after hearing the story of Rama throughout one's childhood. One would quite possibly, probably adopt Rama as a paragon of virtue and as a measurement of how one could behave in the world ideally. Mm-hmm. For example, so the sutra, right? Like the Yoga Sutras, where you have Yoga is a cessation of fluctuations of the mind, Sutra 1, and then you have potential exposition in a oral tradition. And then you have, then the seer resides in his own state. And you have these sutras, these aphorisms, these kernels of knowledge. The narrative texts are such that I liken them to the philosophies in there, in the way that there's coconut water and coconut, but it has to be cracked, or the lemon has to be squeezed, right? It's in there, but it's for us to now apply our conscious mind and our analytical wits to disentangle what the text is doing by its very design, mostly in an unconscious fashion. So narrative is didactic, I believe categorically, but certainly in Hindu world. More often than not, what you have, the whole point of the frame narrative is because is to show that there is an individual who has a question, who needs to learn something. He needs knowledge. He needs transformation. And so that very device points to how the tradition wants us to harness the text. So the king is disempowered. He becomes empowered at the end. This text, these series of mythologies, are about empowerment. So, and, yes.
Yeah, I love your illustrations of the lemon juice and the coconut, which would take a little extra work. Have you tried to crack a coconut lately? As I recall, there's a soft spot. But anyway, great illustration. When the coconut is cracked, you know, what is the coconut note? Is it the text is trying to teach the tradition, as you say, like the honor the Vedic tradition, find a fascination in the Upanishadic era, and then now that we're into the Puranic Bhakti period, is there this synthesis of all that has gone before and what is current now, and the text is trying to harness the legacy for the reader to learn and hopefully understand it and integrate into their life?
Well, it would be so dizzying to try to synthesize logically thousands of years of religious history. And so the text does what only narrative can. It interweaves these disparate strands so masterfully, in that we certainly have the Vedic element. You know, the goddess is literally praised by the gods as a Vedic recitation. They invoke her as Vedic recitation. There's a verse from there are four hymns in the text. Two are Thanksgiving hymns and two are hymns of invocation. Mm-hmm. And the first Thanksgiving hymn in chapter four, the Shukradi Stuti, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous hymn. It's the only portion of the text in an elegant meter, in the Vasanta Tilaka meter. And they basically say that you are the essence whereby the gods are satisfied in Vedic ritual. Through the swaha, when you say swaha, the gods are satisfied. You are that essence. When you're doing rituals for filial piety to the ancestors, you say swada. And they're saying you are also that. So they liken her to the essence of Vedic ritual. They also obviously liken her as the power, the shakti required to attain the Upanishadic paragon. The apex of the Upanishadic ideology, they say, look, well, you also are what the sages contemplate to shear off all of their flaws. You are that knowledge that gives them truth. In the same hymn, they're saying she's both. And the hymn itself is what? The hymn itself is a devotional hymn. The gods are singing their love and their appreciation to the goddess. And so the frame narrative very clearly lays out the idiom of bhakti. And that is whereby, you know, they sit down and they devote themselves. They offer fruits and flowers and incense to a murti that they craft by a riverbank of the Devi. They use a bhakti idiom. It's profound. It's so unassuming. The frame narrative basically says you can use a bhakti idiom to acquire the fruits of Vedic ritual and acquire the fruits of Upanishadic speculation, because it's all grounded in the one true power, which is the Devi.
And speaking of that power, one of the things that I noticed in your work was that you do bring a corrective to academic opinion, scholarship, if you will. On page 138, you mention some scholarly opinions on or conceptions to Durga's source of power, that it is not her own, but it's derived. And you challenge that with a thesis that she is autonomous in her power. And to me, that looks like a pretty strong corrective, especially when you you tackle Doniger on page 138, 139. Can you comment on how you came upon that that view?
Sure. So this is the first time, right? This is so. Let's think about this for a moment. Take a step back. Hinduism, we are taught, or we teach Hinduism in terms of being comprised of, you know, various philosophical strands. But in terms of sectarian Hinduism, although there are many, many, many gods that one can invoke, Ganesha is a household deity for everyone. Generally, Hindus will elect as their supreme face of the divine Vishnu, Shiva, or the goddess. You know, this is the way we teach it through Hinduism.
Right.
So goddess veneration or Shaktism is, you know, one third of this vast religion. This is the very first text of the goddess in Sanskrit. And no one before this thesis has bothered to look at the text as a whole. No one has bothered to analyze the text as a whole, frame it all, understand how the text is working on its own terms. This thesis shows that the text, in the way we have it currently, it's a very stable text now. That the text has an integrity of its own, despite the multiple authorship, either throughout the various stages of tacking on or in the final stage, a great deal of conscious awareness was applied to the form and the structure of the text and the role of that form and structure in exerting influence over exegesis. The whole point of it is to point to us across time how the text wishes to be read. Now, this is an idea of Umberto Eco. He basically says texts are interpretation machines. They posit by their very fabric how they want to be read, who their model reader is. So in one text, a rabbit hole is expected, and another text, a magic rabbit hole is jarring, because the text itself will tell you whether it wants to be read in such a manner that would be acceptable in terms of your suspension of disbelief. And so in looking at the text as a whole, we see that this episode, that is the middle episode and the most important episode in my opinion, which is why it relates to by far the most famous iconographical moment of the Devi, with her slaying the buffalo demon pinned beneath her shula, her spear, and her lion taking care of part of the form as well. This very famous iconographical moment is essentially what is celebrated in the middle episode. Now, from that episode alone, if you look at it as a fragment, it is, I certainly understand and resonate with why one would get, one would conclude that the Devi is comprised of the power of all the gods, because how she emerges is all the gods are really ticked off at you know, this big old buffalo demon stole Indra's throne, and Indra goes to Vishnu and Shiva, the great gods, and says, look what's going on here. And they're all so angered, so incensed, that from their wrath, this fire, this Tejas emerges from all of their wrath, and the Devi is born from their wrath, and they clone all their weapons and gives the Devi a weapon in kind. So Shiva clones his trident, for example, and the goddess therefore has a trident. In the context of that episode, it's understandable why one would conclude that she's comprised of the powers of the gods. However, if you understand that that's the second episode, the reason the first episode is the way that it is, and I'm certainly not the first scholar to point this out or argue this, the first episode shows that the goddess is there at Pralaya, at the dissolution of the last age. Vishnu is sleeping on a serpent couch. Brahma is about to create a universe anew. And even in that moment, in that crevice before the dawn of time, the Devi is already there. They invoke her and she emerges from the body of Vishnu. She emerges from the body of Vishnu. So the point of entry of the goddess in all the episodes is from someone else's body. that doesn't so much bespeak the idea that they create the goddess. It bespeaks the idea that the primordial power is in all life. It's in all of us. It's within us. So in every episode, she emerges from the bodies of other beings.
Mm.
Nothing exists because she, even when she manifests other goddesses, they emerge from her body. She doesn't snap her fingers and will them into existence. And that's a very important trope. So what I would say in terms of a corrective is twofold. By looking at it as a whole, you're going to get a different composite picture, especially when you understand the mechanics of ring composition. Secondly, that is how you understand that the second episode, whereby the goddess restores the throne of heaven, is what the text is prioritizing. It's saying, look here, look to this royal ideology piece, look at the importance of the goddess. It's saying, this is what is most important in the world of the text. And so royal ideology eclipses ascetic ideology, because ascetic ideology is nowhere to be found in that middle episode, although it pervades other points of the text.
Okay, well, thank you for tackling that question. I'm going to add to it a little bit. When I go back to page 67, I think this is the only, time in your book that you refer to Purusha or the cosmic man, but you tie Durga to, or you seem to, if I'm understanding you correctly, in Puranic accounts of creation, you write the cosmic man emits various items and entities without being depleted in the process, like Durga. So are you framing Durga as an equivalent to Purusha, or just help me understand what you're doing there?
So Durga is literally a personification of power in the text. Power is something that various entities and gods can have, power is something that the Devi is. So while those of us who possess power can be exhausted of our supplies of power, power itself can never be exhausted of power. And so the Devi never tires. It's against the fabric of the mythologization of power itself. She's not exhausted by any of the manifestations of power that she puts forth, because she is power itself. Another way of looking at that is that no demon can have more power than the Devi, because the power that they have is only a portion of the power that she is.
And so is she equivalent to Purusha? Are they distinct? Are we looking at another binary?
Purusha in the Samkhya sense, like Purusha and Prakriti?
Yeah.
So the text takes various philosophical strands. The goddess as Maya, for example, in Advaita Vedanta, or the goddess as Shakti. And the text draws on those philosophical strands and interweaves them in a way that only narrative can.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, you can look at the Devi as a philosophical principle in these other schools, but the text is saying that, well, she's not just Prakriti in a Purusha Prakriti sense, because she's also beyond the Purusha Prakriti divide.
Okay.
So it's harnessing the available philosophical, theological notions of the feminine, and it's stitching them into a tapestry that's more than the sum of its parts.
Okay. But you're setting this context. Chronologically, we're looking at about 6th century CE.
That's what we surmise.
Yeah.
5th to 8th.
Yeah. And, I mean, help me chronologically. Has the Trimurti of Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva already been established? And this is serving as a corrective to displace Brahma with Shakti? Or is the Vishnu, Shiva, Shakti Trimurti the precedent? And later displaced with Brahma.
Certainly, in the text, we have an understanding that Vishnu and Shiva are great gods, because there are times in which, for example, in the middle episode, the Vedic gods of heaven, they go to these great gods of Hinduism. Now they go to Shiva, they go to Vishnu to complain. So it has this idea that there is the Vedic pantheon above and beyond the Vedic pantheon, there are the three gods of the pertaining to these three cosmogonic functions. So Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva are all in the text. And it's clear that they play a larger role. For example, in the first episode, it's Pralaya, it's dissolution. There are no Vedic gods. There are no heavens in the sense of a throne for Indra to rule. What we have is Brahma and a sleeping Vishnu. So the text very consciously presents a force that is greater than even the great gods of Hinduism. Brahma, for example, in his praise, to invoke her, he praises her. In the first praise of the text, Brahma praises Devi to invoke her. So we have the creator at the beginning of time, the creator god at the beginning of time, calling forth this primordial, mysterious mother, right? And he basically says, like, you are the power whereby I am embodied. You are the power whereby Vishnu is embodied. He says this quite literally. You are the power by Shiva's embodied. How on earth can I praise you? You're even the power of praise itself. What am I doing here? I'm praising you, but you're beyond, even beyond. And he says that quite literally. So the text definitely presents in mythologizing power itself and equating that with the great goddess. It really is this brilliant move where any powerful being in the universe is a portion of the supreme power, which is the goddess.
And is she, I know with Shiva, he's going to be compared to Rudra in the Vedic pantheon, as you mentioned, the Vedic pantheon. Is Durga in any way correlated with one of the goddesses of the Vedic era, you know, Vak or Prithvi?
You have the Vedic... So one of, I believe it's Coburn who phrased it this way, that while in the Vedic era and beyond there are goddesses of Hinduism, they're small g goddesses in the way that the Greek pantheon has an Artemis or a Diana. Mm. For example, this is the first time we have a capital G goddess for which there is no correlate.
Right.
There is no idea of such in the Vedic worldview. If, for example, if you can correlate Lakshmi to the idea of Shri, there's this very ancient Shri Suktam, for example, that's often chanted in Vedic sacrifice. That's still understood as a small G goddess or a consort goddess.
Yeah.
And this is the first time you see a large G goddess or the divine itself.
And the small
Ishvara itself is feminine,
right, and all the small g goddesses have their they are consorts, are they not?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Raj, I don't know how much more time we have. Are there any themes that I've missed in my questioning that you'd like to pick up on before we close off?
Nothing really comes to mind. I think you touched on, well, you know, what are the main themes of the book? The main themes are that narrative is tremendously didactic, and we need to learn how to read it on its own terms. This particular narrative encodes an opposition, in a way, encodes the structural opposition of royal and ascetic ideologies that we call the Dharma of Double Helix. And it does so as to privilege royal power, because the goddess fulfills the role of the sovereign on the cosmic sphere. I'd say those are the biggest takeaways from the book. It, in terms of its correctives, it corrects the ways in which we read Puranas, mm-hmm. taking them as meaningful wholes. It corrects the idea that the merchant is favored in the book. Clearly, at least I argue that the king is the favored character of the book. It also corrects this idea of the Hindu goddess as terrifying and wrathful. There are associations of Durga worship with taboo, marginalized tribal practices. But once we understand the text presents her as ultimately a royal figure, a royal goddess, we understand that it primes us to understand that her wrathful emanations are an episodic break from her benign order-granting essence. So those are essentially the main takeaways from the book, and I think we pretty much touched on all of that.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure to chat with you, and I really appreciate you inviting me to walk through some of these questions with you, and I do trust that your book will make the impact that you're hoping it will.
Well, thank you for your time, Craig, and I'm sure we'll have many more conversations on and off the air.
Okay, thanks so much, Rod.
Okay, bye-bye.